So good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming out. I'm sure there may be a few of you here who didn't realize you were walking in halfway through a weekend retreat, and that is okay. You can just join in, even if it's just for this morning. This is the second day of our annual retreat that focuses on the writings and teachings of Dogen Zenji, who was a monk in the 13th century Japan who traveled to China and lived and practiced there for 5 years and brought this particular style of Zen practice back to Japan, and then ultimately it comes to us here. And Dogen's noted for the depth and philosophical quality of his writing. But don't be deceived by the philosophical quality of his writing. He is talking about how we live and practice in our everyday lives. That's really a characteristic of this style of practice. It's very much on the ground. But his writing style, it can make your head spin a little. So it helps once in a while to get together and read Dogen together and unpack it a little bit and look at some of the and benefit from some of the work that's gone before to understand Dogen. And at the same time, we have to be really okay with not understanding Dogen. Don't try to understand Dogen in any conventional way at all, but just let his words, the images, just kind of penetrate. And gradually, as I said yesterday, over time, the more one reads Dogen or chants Dogen and ultimately sits and practices sit zazen in the spirit of Dogen, somehow Dogen's message, little images, phrases, just begin to penetrate quite deeply and affect how we practice and how we live. So, how many people were not here yesterday? Yeah, quite a few. So let's do a little review. The title of the text that we are studying this weekend is called Uji in Japanese. And these are the Chinese characters that say Uji. How would you read it in Mandarin?
Yoshi.
Yeah. So they're related, because this came, the Uji is a Japanese pronunciation of the Chinese. So this is, first character is being. Can also mean having, but typically in this case it means being. And time, being time. That's the most literal translation of this title. And sometimes it's translated as the time being, or for the time being. And I think that that's actually a little misleading, because in English that's a colloquial expression that means provisionally, you know, for this period of time and then not. And that's not Dogen's meaning here, as you will see. Being time is both infinite and right now, in this particular moment. Dogen is proposing a view of time that is quite different from our conventional view of time as linear and sequential. He describes time as being itself, of time and being as the same thing, in essence, as life and form manifesting moment to moment in a vast dynamic net of interconnection. We talked about Indra's net And I'm sure many of you are familiar with that image of Indra's net as an infinite net, and at every intersection in the net, every node is a jewel that reflects every other jewel. And in Dogen's view, each jewel would be a moment of being time, which are also called Dharma positions. And they're not in any way static. They're always changing in connection to all other Dharma positions. And we also talked about how any point, those points of experience, of moment, of being time, are also pivot points of awakening, where we can shift from a contracted self-focused view to a spacious view that includes the reality of all existence. And that word, there's a word that we talked about yesterday that is often translated, it can be translated as moving, passing, changing, circulating, I've seen all those, but the one we used is flowing. Then this translation is flowing, is this dynamic quality of being time that Dogen describes in the first half, yesterday mostly. Let's look, for the sake of review and because I like it so much, let's read together the verse that begins this whole text. Dogen is quoting Zen Master Yaoshan from the 8th century, the Tang Dynasty. And this is how Dogen begins his discussion of being time. Also, you'll note, so I retranslate. I didn't like the translation exactly of in this. This is Kaz Tanahashi's translation that I'm using, and I do think it's our best choice for this weekend and most accessible of the translations that I looked at. I looked at least four, maybe five, and I looked at the original, the Japanese. And I think Kaz's is the best choice, but he uses the time being. And so I changed every time where he says the time being to being time. So you'll see that as we read. So let's read the verse together. Everybody have it? Being time, standing on a mountain peak. Being time, going to the depths of the ocean. Being time, a three-headed, eight-armed demon. Being time, a six-foot standing Buddha, an eight-foot seated Buddha. Being time, a staff and a fly whisk. Being time, a temple pillar, a lantern. Being time, third son of Chan, fourth son of Li. Being time, great earth, the vast sky. So if you notice, these are kind of paired lines. Oh, Michael, could you be kind enough to bring me the visual aids from the table in there? These are paired lines that seem to be opposites or in contrast. And Dogen's point is that these aspects of our lives are not separate, that these are present in our life in every moment of being time and in everyone else's. So, you know, we stand on a mountain peak, we go to the depths of the ocean. Sorry, this arm fell off. There. I just gotta get it on right. There he is. You know, sometimes we we have peak experiences, right? And sometimes we plunge to the depths of human despair. But those are not... Those are states that are constantly shifting. You know, we can't hang on or repudiate. Either we can't repudiate what we would rather disown, right? And we can't hang on to our highest aspirations. So this is an asura. This is the three-headed, says eight arms in the text. This guy's only got six. And I told people about him yesterday. I got him from a vending machine in Japan. Only in Japan can you get a Buddhist image from a vending machine. Collect the whole set of 12. They're great. And this is the original. This is an 8th century image of the asura from ancient Nara, the old capital in Japan, before Kyoto. It's actually very beautiful. And as we said, an asura is sort of a tormented being. He's always tormented by sort of a type A personality where, you know, you have to be better than everybody else, and you have to, and then that means you're disparaging just about everybody else. You never have enough wealth or power or this is the realm of envy and competition and aggression, this asura realm. And it's one of the six realms on the Wheel of Life that you often see in Tibetan tankas. There's the heavenly realm, where life is easy and it's easy to be complacent, and it's easy to tip right over into the hell realm from the heavenly realm. And then there's the asura realm, which is off to the one side of the heavenly realm, and the human realm's on the other side. The human realm is where we have enough self-awareness to do this practice and to awaken to our true nature. We have enough suffering to prod us to do that, to look closer, look deeper. And then down at the bottom, opposite the heavenly realm, is the hell realm. The hell realm is the realm of despair and fear, terror, very primal. And then over at the other side of the hell realm is the hungry ghost realm, which is the realm of endless craving. Our society is really encourages hungry ghost cravings. The consumer culture and addictive culture of our society is a sort of hungry ghost realm. We all have each of these, right? You can go through all these realms in a day, right? In an hour, sitting here in a zazen period. And the one I left out is the animal realm. The animal realm is your basic needs. I want it now. I don't care what anybody else's needs. I want this. You know, it's sort of a greedy kind of realm, which, not to do a disservice to the animals, but that's because really we're worse. We're greedier than they are. But it's those kind of I want it and I want it now kind of realm. So the asura here is a stand-in for all those realms of discomfort and, you know, that we'd rather disown. And then paired with the 16-foot golden shining Buddha, or the 8-foot seated Buddha, which is also always present and manifesting in our lives as well, and all around us. So these are paired aspects of being time, right? The staff and the fly whisk are ceremonial objects, originally just practical objects, but became ceremonial objects in a Buddhist priest's life. And then the temple pillar is often really large, supporting a big temple, and the lantern on either side of the altar or at the entrance So this pair could be symbolizing the teacher and the student. Was one suggestion that I read, but it could also be the staff and the fly whisk are the monk out in the mountains on pilgrimage, and the tent pillar and the lantern are the practice place. So you can take it different ways. Again, they're paired aspects of our experience, right? You know, there's that experience of leaving home and finding our way in the world, and there's that experience of being rooted in our place. Right? And then third son of Chang and fourth son of Li. Chang and Li are really ordinary names. They're Smith and Jones, and the third son and the fourth son are probably not very distinguished because they're not going to inherit the family fortune. So these are just ordinary people. All of us, you know, we're just little ordinary people living this short life. And at the same time, we are the great earth and the vast sky. We are all these things, is what Dogen is telling us over and over again in this text. So let's read some of the text. Unfortunately, this third section, I think, is the hardest section. So for those jumping in, please bear with us. Those who were here yesterday will have a little better preparation. So we are on section number 13. And I would like a volunteer to read that for us. Someone willing? Eden?
You may suppose that time is only passing away and not understand that time never arrives. Although understanding itself is time, understanding does not depend on its own arrival. People only see times coming and going and do not thoroughly understand that being time, the time being, abides in each moment. Then, when can they penetrate the barrier? Even if people recognized being time, the time being, in each moment, who could give expression to this recognition? Even if they could give expression to this recognition for a long time, who could stop looking for the realization of the original face? According to an ordinary person's view of being time, the time being, even enlightenment and nirvana as being time, the time being, would be merely aspects of coming and going.
Okay, thank you. That's pretty hard to take in, just read through like that. And so, you know, Dogen's writing is something you read like poetry. You read it over and over again. You read it a week later, and you see something you didn't see the first time. Something to read slowly. But let me just take an attempt at some paraphrasing here to help you. Dogen says, people only see times coming and going and do not thoroughly understand that being time abides in each moment. Again, he's saying that we have all our conventional ways of viewing time as coming and going. But that's deceptive. Time is not anything other than this dynamic moment after moment after moment. And then he says, even if we recognize this, how can we give expression to it? He's acknowledging how hard it is to even describe what he's saying. And even if we could give expression to it, isn't it hard for us not to stop looking for the realization of the original face? What he's saying, we still want that experience of enlightenment once and for all. Can't we just get it, you know, and have it? It's so easy to slip into the conventional view of enlightenment as something separate from us, out there. Something in the future, something we get and lose, rather than the very ground of our being, the very nature of our moment-to-moment existence. So Dogen tries to help us appreciate this flowing quality of being time. Someone read the next paragraph. And you don't have to say the time being, the paragraph, the parentheses part. You can skip that. Jess, yeah.
Being time is entirely actualized without being caught up in nets or cages. Deva kings and heavenly beings appearing right and left are the being time of your complete effort right now. The being time of all beings throughout the world, in water and on land, just actualizes your complete effort right now. All beings of all kinds in the visible and invisible realms are being time, actualized by your complete effort, flowing due to your complete effort. Closely examine this flowing. Without your complete effort right now, nothing would be actualized, nothing would flow.
Mm-hmm. So being time is not caught up in nets or cages, unrestricted. The nets here are apparently nets that are used to catch birds, and the cages are fish traps, you know, like baskets that used for fish traps. And usually we get snagged. We get caught in cages and nets in our daily lives by our preconceived notions, our habit patterns. You know, we get snagged on a regular basis, don't we? I do. But being time is not, even when we're snagged, actually we're not. Being time is still flowing. And what he's saying here is the being time of each moment is actualizing us of all other, the Deva kings and the heavenly beings and the visible and the invisible, all beings of all kinds are actualizing us and we are actualizing them. So we are co-creating or co-actualizing all the time, whether we know it or not, is what he's saying. The last sentence that says, without your complete effort right now, nothing would be actualized, nothing would flow, could also be translated as, without my complete effort or our complete effort, it has all those meanings. His point being that the life force of each being, your life force, my life force, our life force, is expressed in each moment of being time. And that creates this world of existence, this universe. Okay, someone please. Chenille, could you read 15?
Do not think flowing is like wind and rain moving from east to west. The entire world is not unchangeable, not immovable. It flows. Flowing is like spring. Spring with all its numerous aspects is called flowing. When spring flows, there is nothing outside of spring. Study this in detail. Spring always flows through spring. Although flowing itself is not spring, flowing occurs throughout spring. Thus, flowing is complete at just this moment of spring. Examine this thoroughly, coming and going. In your study of flowing, if you imagine the objective to be outside yourself and that you flow and move through hundreds and thousands of worlds for hundreds, thousands, and myriad of eons, you have not devotedly studied the Buddha way.
Okay, I'm not going to take the time to break that down sentence by sentence, but you can see that he's using the seasons, specifically spring, to illustrate his point about flowing quality of being time. Even though this language seems kind of impenetrable, and believe me, other translations don't improve on it, Dogen is saying, don't see the flowing of being time just as a wind or rain blowing through. It's much more complex. You know, you usually see a particular event, we say, oh, that happened. It's much more complex. So he's saying, imagine the springtime. all the elements, all the life forms interacting, coming into being and transforming that we see when spring arrives in a sort of complex, interwoven sort of tapestry of relationships. So he's giving us kind of an ecosystem view of being time here. Imagine yourself as a tree, right? A tree in the forest. And your roots. You know, we chant all my ancient twisted karma, so that's our roots, right? Intertwining with all the other elements in the soil, the other roots in the trees. Recent research is telling us how trees actually have this way of communicating through chemicals, through their roots, so that if there's a threat, it will be communicated to a distant tree. It's pretty amazing. And of course the relationship between mycorrhizae of fungi and trees, the symbiotic relationships between trees and fungi, we're learning about. So there's the relationships happening through our roots as trees, and then our branches and our leaves, right? Our leaves are breathing all the time. We're taking in pollution. Through air, through water, right? Water circulating through us. We are permeable beings, right? Life is flowing through us all the time. That's what he's saying here. It's kind of a vast ecosystem. And we are mistaken, he says, if we reduce this wondrous complexity by thinking that enlightenment, or anything else for that matter, is an external objective, distant from us in space and time. In another fascicle of Dogen, he uses a flower. It's called the Udambara flower. The Udambara flower is the flower of the tree, the Bodhi tree that the Buddha sat beneath when he was enlightened. And it's also said to be, Dogen's using it to refer to the flower that the Buddha is said to have held up before his assembly of monks and twirled. And nobody could respond or say anything except Mahakashapa, who smiled. And the Buddha, that was said to be the Buddha's first Dharma transmission. The Buddha said, I see you, Mahakashapa. You have understood. Let me see if I can... And Dogen writes about this, saying, in his typical way, twirling flowers are twirled by eyes, twirled by mind consciousness, twirled by nostrils, and twirled by flowers twirling. In general, the mountains, rivers, and the earth, the sun and moon, the wind and rain, people, animals, grass, and trees, the miscellaneous things of the present displaying themselves here and there are just the twirling of the Udambara flower. So this is the kind of language he uses. But this lofty vision of being time doesn't boil down to a kind of simplistic message of be here now. Dogen does not deny that we need to be able to function in the relative world of past, present, and future. But we need to see that past, present, and future are alive and always changing and always manifesting in this moment of being time. But of course, we need memory and foresight to be able to think well and function in the everyday world. And this is poignantly evident when we look at the lives of those whose memory is severely impaired through injury or illness. Oliver Sacks, have people read Oliver Sacks? He's an anthropologist on Mars, is one of his well-known books. Wonderful writer and neurologist. Writes about a young man who had a rather conventional upbringing in Queens, New York, in the 1950s. He became part of the drug culture of the 60s. He was a devoted Grateful Dead fan. But in the 70s, he left drugs behind, and he joined the Society of Krishna Consciousness, better known to most of us as the Hare Krishnas, who still exist, apparently. At which point, he cut off virtually all contact with his parents and lived in an ashram in New Orleans, where gradually he began to complain that his vision was growing dim. But the Swami who led the group dismissed his concern, saying that the visual effects were signs of his spiritual progress. Reading from the book, his sight grew still dimmer, but he offered no further complaints. And indeed, he seemed to be becoming more spiritual by the day. An amazing new serenity had taken hold of him. He no longer showed his previous impatience or appetites, and he was sometimes found in a sort of daze, with a strange, some said transcendental, smile on his face. "It is beatitude," said his Swami. "He is becoming a saint." The temple felt he needed to be protected at this stage. He no longer went out or did anything unaccompanied, and contact with the outside world was strongly discouraged. So meanwhile, his parents had been receiving occasional reports that were so out of character with this young man's, with the young man they knew, the son they knew. They finally decided to find out for themselves. They went to the ashram. They found him blind, fat, hairless, and making vague, incoherent comments. They had him admitted to hospital, where he was found to have an immense tumor that had destroyed his pituitary gland, as well as his eyesight. After surgery, he was left with profoundly impaired short-term memory and amnesia for most of the events past 1970, although he retained lots of Grateful Dead trivia. Sacks first met him when he was 25 and living in a long-term care facility. He was bland, placid, and emotionally flat. Reading from the book, he seemed to exist only in the present, only in response to the immediacy of stimuli around him. If he was not stimulated, he fell into a sort of daze. Left alone, he would spend hours in the ward without spontaneous activity. This inert state was at first described as by the nurses as brooding. It had been seen in the temple as meditating. Yeah. My own feeling was that it was a profoundly pathological mental idling, almost devoid of mental content or affect. It was difficult to give it a name, to give a name to this state, so different from alert, attentive wakefulness, but also clearly quite different from sleep. It had a blankness resembling no normal state. So I'm giving you this exaggerated example to say this is not what we aim for in our practice. You know, people come and say, "Oh, I'm a terrible meditator because I can't have a blank mind." Well, no, that's not the point. Sometimes we are very still, and sometimes content, feelings arises. How do we hold and release those arisings is what Dogen is helping us with here. One of the best memoirs I've read in a long time is The Three Dog Life by Abigail Thomas, by writer. You know the expression three-dog night? It was a band back in some time. Three Dog Night is a really cold night in Africa. Australia. Where you need three dogs to keep you warm. So Three Dog Life is what she needed to survive what happened to her after her husband had a catastrophic brain injury from being struck by a car while walking their dog. Here's what she described. His state. The nurses say he can stand in front of the bathroom mirror for an hour or more, toothbrush in his hand. In brain injury jargon, perhaps this is what is meant by difficulty completing a task. The first time I heard this term, I imagined a child who can't manage tying shoelaces, a grown-up who forgets how to scramble eggs, some kind of visible difficulty, frustration, something that could be relearned. I didn't know about the getting stuck. For my husband, there's no such thing as a minute ago. There is no, but we've been sitting here for an hour and a half. That information has nowhere to lodge in his consciousness. He has a collapsing past. If he doesn't remember, he doesn't believe. And if everything is now, what's the rush? I used to try and coax him, nudge him on, but that only made him angry and confused. So I have adapted. I join him. We sit and steep ourselves in 10:37, a single moment, while outside this room an hour disappears, bypassing us. I'm always surprised when I look at the clock to find out how long we've been there. In one moment of startling clarity, he told me, my future has been dismantled. We can learn a lot from spending time with someone who's in that state. So impaired that their present is very contracted. The amazing thing is that they're still, even though the past is, what was the word she used, and the future is dismantled, there's still a connection. There's still a connection in the moment to vastness. My mom's 96. She remembers very little. We sit and look out the window. And one day she turned and said to me, I'm just appreciating the astonishment. And I said, yeah, me too. Here we are, appreciating the astonishment. And she'll say, what's that pink over there? I said, that's a dogwood blooming. That's a pink dogwood. Oh, I didn't know there were pink dogwoods. Yeah, there are white ones and pink ones. 10 minutes later, what's that pink over there? That's a pink dogwood. And freshly amazed that there are pink and white dogwoods. So I enjoyed that with her, right? But I also ask myself, and the other great thing, the other sad and, you know, bittersweet thing about my mom and her memory is she doesn't remember her grievances. So all the hurts in her relationship with my dad, she doesn't remember. And her resentment that, you know, she blamed him for putting her in long-term care, she doesn't remember after her second head bonk. So now she's delighted. He's her faithful visitor. She adores him. And so I have had cause to ask myself, how long am I going to take my grievances along with me in their cages, you know, and nets, dragging them along in my heavy baggage? Am I going to wait till I get a couple of head bonks in my 90s? Or am I going to let them free from their cages and nets? And so we can learn a thing or two from being with people whose present has contracted so much. And yet they're still connected in some mysterious way. It's a hard way to learn to live in the moment, but she learned. She learned how to love her husband and be with him in his altered state. And at the same time, she also learned how to rebuild her life so that she would have a life that was not completely subsumed into his contracted world. So I give you these examples to say, yeah, we need our thoughts. We need to think well, to use our human capacity for memory and foresight to function in our lives and in our relationships. The trouble with thinking, though, is that we tend to think way more than we actually need to for optimum effectiveness, right? We waste a lot of time and energy fretting, replaying the past, worrying about the future, perseverating. We spin our wheels deeper and deeper into the neurological ruts made by often trauma, you know, past hurts. We create a me against the world response to threat so that we armor ourselves against experiencing the truth that the golden Buddhas are all around us, and it's not all asuras around us, although there's some of them, you know, it's all mixed up together. And we're connected. Always, always. There are times when we do have to respond to threat and keep ourselves safe. But mostly we spend way more time in defense mode than our actual life and relationships warrant. Our relationship to past and future becomes an effort to understand and control our lives so that nothing bad happens to us and those we love or what we care about. To think about past and future, we have to imagine past and future and form images in our mind, right? And you might say, well, yes, I'm imagining the future, but I'm not imagining the past. I remember, that's what happened, right? But when we use our memory, we construct images in our mind or verbal replays of conversations, and these reconstructions are not the experience itself. The reconstructions that we create right now. When we remember something from the past or imagine something in the future, we are having a present experience of that, of remembering or imagining. Have you ever observed how different family members have completely different memories of the same incident? Right? No, that's what happened. No, that's what happened. Right? You said that. No, I never said that. Or maybe you've been convinced that you remember and were present on a particular occasion in the past. Have you ever had this happen? And then you realize, wait a minute, I couldn't have been. I wasn't even born yet. I'm remembering the photo or the story, right? Have you ever had that happen or seen somebody else do it, right? Or maybe you've noticed how the brain fills in gaps in our memories with some likely story or how our brain confuses two facts. Or how somebody, usually we notice other people doing it. We don't notice when we do it. Michael can verify that. And perhaps you've noticed or experienced, those of you who may have experienced the death of a parent or someone else close at a young age, how your memory and experience of that person evolves as you mature and grow older. You look back and you see that person very differently from when you were 10 compared to when you're 50. You know, it's always a big threshold when someone who's lost a parent early reaches the age of that parent, and they suddenly look back and see that parent in a different way. So our memory, so we, you know, the past is changing with us as we change. There is no definitive version. Memory and foresight are always partial, always provisional, based on our limited perceptions and views, and subject to revision and change. This is what Dogen is calling flowing. This is what he's calling being time and vivid life experience. And so the more we look into the nature of memory, of foresight, imagination, the more we see into the nature of being time itself, that boundless ecosystem of our lives, the more we can open up those nets and traps and snares of attachment and clinging to our version of reality. And then the more flexibility, fluidity, creativity we let into our living, vivid life as it is. Dogen says in another text called Continuous Practice, on the great road of Buddha ancestors, there is always unsurpassable practice, continuous and sustained. And he means living of your life, not just the zazen, but the living of your life. It forms the circle of the way and is never cut off. Between aspiration, practice, enlightenment, and nirvana, there is not a moment's gap. Continuous practice is the circle of the way. So I've talked more than enough. I want you to have a chance to share some reflections with each other now. And I'd like you to just take a moment before we get into small groups to see if you can think of a time, an example of a way that you've been snared, you know, caught in one of those nets or traps in your life experience. And how maybe it opened up, shifted, or if you feel like you're trapped in one still right now, how could this kind of ecosystem view, spacious view of your life and time, open that up, that constricted place, that trapped, snared place in your experience? Okay, so just let's just sit for some moments just to see what surfaces for you. And you can take an easy example. You don't have to take the hardest thing in your whole life. Just an example.